Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is off this week. I'm Brian Ellison. What is identity? And how does a child come to have one? It's easy to name some identities, to understand why a person defines oneself that way. They're deaf, they're autistic. There are other identities, though, that don't show up in a newborn or a toddler's testing, but become identity builders nonetheless, being gay, being a gifted child prodigy. No matter what is different about a kid, though, being different is hard, and not just for the child, for the parents, too. So how do parents come to accept that their children are different? Different from them, and different, perhaps, than what they might have hoped? How does that difference and that acceptance shape the child's life and our society? Joining us today is Andrew Solomon. He's won a whole shelf of awards for his book last year, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Just came out in paperback. He's joining us this morning from the studios of Sirius XM in New York City. Andrew Solomon, welcome to Up to Date.
What a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So let's start with that question that I started with. What is identity?
Identity is the set of characteristics or ideas by which someone defines himself and his place in the world. And there are many different kinds of identities. They can include your ethnicity, your nationality, your religion, your disability status. There are all kinds of other things that become defining characteristics as identities. It's a broad encompassing concept, but it's an area of great comfort to people when they begin to establish what their identities are and stop floundering around in the midst of chaos.
Well, and that's an interesting question, too. Why is it so important for us to be able to assign those labels, those names to who we are?
It's important for a number of reasons. Primary among them, I would say, is that it's very lonely having characteristics that you don't share with anybody else. If I were the only gay person in the world, if you were the only man in the world, if one of your listeners were the only person in Kansas, that's a lonely way to be. And I think that the experience of forming identity is partly an experience of forming community. It's finding other people. From those other people, you get knowledge about what it is you're experiencing. You sometimes get legislation that is passed to protect people who belong to unusual or especially stigmatized identities. You get a sense of who you are yourself, and you reach a kind of peace with yourself in knowing that while you're a unique individual, you also are part of this broader fabric of humanity.
So how does a child then come to know their identity or have an identity?
The central argument, or at least one of the central arguments of my book, is that there are really two kinds of identity. There are what I've called vertical identities, which are passed down generationally from parent to child. So your ethnicity, your nationality, often your language, often your religion. These are all things that parents are likely to have in common with their children. And even though some of those identities can be difficult, there's not really any research into how to make them go away. No one is trying to figure out how to ensure that the next generation of African-American or Latino children are born with blonde hair and blue eyes, even though there are difficulties in the U.S. with having those minority identities. Right. But there are also what I've called horizontal identities. Horizontal because membership in those identities isn't passed down from parent to child within the family. It's something the child learns from a peer group. So being gay, being deaf, being a dwarf, being autistic, having Down syndrome, these other characteristics that I looked at in my book are all things in which a child has an identity which is different from his parents' identity. And having a child who's different is a very nerve-wracking procedure, and parents have tried time out of mind to correct or fix those stigmatized horizontal identities. So there's been research on that all the time. So really, I've broken identity into those two categories. And of course, most people have multiple identities. I mean, you may have the vertical identity of being the same ethnicity as your parent and the horizontal ethnicity of being transgender when neither of your parents is.
I can't help but notice, though, a lot of those horizontal identities, as you call them, whether it be blindness or deafness or dwarfism or sexual orientation, being gay, those do not all seem like they're in the same category. Those are very different kinds of differences.
As long as we think of each difference individually, and there are many reasons to think of each difference individually, we're dealing with a relatively small, narrow silo. We're dealing with the world of people who have schizophrenia, or the world of people who have Down syndrome, or the world of people who are musical prodigies. when we allow ourselves to think that the idea for parents of negotiating the difficult experience of difference in their children is something that unites all those people, then we're suddenly looking at a large swath of humanity. In fact, we're looking at most of humanity, because I have yet to meet any parent who hasn't occasionally looked at his child and said, "What planet did you come from?"
Right. So the ones that are sort of uniformly understood as something that is not good, not something you would want for your child. Let's take something like autism. How do those things go from being seen as an illness or as something that's wrong to actually being the basis of forming a community around that thing?
I begin in all of those questions with my own experience, which is that I'm gay. And when I was born, being gay was an illness. It was a crime, and it was a sin. And now it's an identity. And the starting point of this book really was to say, if the condition I have could go from being an illness to being an identity over a relatively short period of 50 years, then what are the other conditions we think of as illnesses that might in fact be experienced as identities? And I ultimately believe that you can describe any characteristic at all as being an illness if you want to speak about its negative side, or as an identity if you want to talk about its empowering side. And that people are constantly shifting back and forth within their own experience of their own characteristic between the illness and the identity model, that there's a lot of fluidity there.
So talk about how that has happened with something like, say, deafness, where clearly there is a community that has a deaf culture, but also there's a sort of a medical side, the simple fact that children are born who cannot hear.
I started off this whole book with an assignment from my editors at the New York Times Magazine about 20 years ago when they asked me to investigate deaf culture. And I was very taken aback. I thought deafness was obviously a terrible misfortune. Those poor people, they couldn't hear. What could be done for them? And then I went out into the deaf world. I went to deaf clubs. I went to deaf theater. I went to houses where the alarm clock was a flashing light and people communicated with their pet in sign. I even went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, Tennessee, where everyone complained about the slurry Southern signing. And as I got deeper and deeper into the world of the deaf, I became more and more convinced that it really was a culture. It's a culture that's organized around the shared use of sign language. And the people who are in it have a great intimacy in it. And there were deaf events I went to at which I thought, not long term, I want to lose my hearing, but I thought, I wish I were deaf because this is such a vivid culture and such an intimate culture. And then I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents and that they discover that deaf community usually in adolescence or thereafter. Now, deafness is also a disability. There are many ways in which it's very inconvenient being unable to hear. But a lot of deaf people have said that while they have hearing loss, they also have deaf gain. Deaf gain being the experience of being part of a larger society. Deaf gain being the sense that the deaf world is a world that has its own literature, its own comedy, its own sense of humor, its own traditions, its own integrity, and that they found a lot of meaning being in that world.
It seems to me that there's a difference, though, between something like deafness, where, as you say, there is an entire culture that has risen up, theater, music, and so on, but not the same with something like Down syndrome or autism, each of which has a chapter in your books. How do those things get to the place where they are an identity that can actually be celebrated?
Autism is an identity that's very much celebrated. There's a big autism rights movement, the neurodiversity movement, which is really all about celebrating autism as an identity. And the people who are in it feel very strongly about it. Now, autism is a term that encompasses both high-functioning activists and a child in the corner banging his head against the wall. And sometimes it's difficult to unite what's true of one of those groups of people with what's true of another.
Right.
But the neurodiversity movement of people who say, without us, you wouldn't have all the technology you have, and who say autistic ways of thinking are extremely valuable, and who point out autistic people can achieve certain things that non-autistic people can't achieve, those people have a very real and vital voice. For Down syndrome, I saw the sense of identity as rising up in some considerable part among families of people with Down syndrome as much as among those people themselves. But even there, I went to the lunch of the National Down Syndrome Society a couple of months ago, and lots of people had brought their kids with Down syndrome. Now, the people organizing it didn't have DS. The people organizing it had to be able to organize a big, complicated lunch, and that was something that was beyond the capacity of the people with DS. But there was a real feeling of joy in the room among these children, many of whom were very sweet-natured and very affectionate. There was a lot of embracing, and a lot of them were very proud. And one of them, speaking of the actor who's on Glee, described herself as having Down syndrome just like him. And one of the people who ran the Down Syndrome Society described going out to lunch with the actor who's on Glee, on whose name I'm embarrassingly blanking for the moment. But described going out to lunch with him, and she said people were coming over to get his autograph. He was a celebrity first and a person with a disability second. Mm. That's been a huge cultural change that's taken place. More and more people are able to find that sense of identity, even of celebrity, in the ways in which they're different.
We're talking with Andrew Solomon. He's the author of the book Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. He's joining us from New York City here on Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. Andrew, you've mentioned one of the ways that society comes to accept differences is through celebrity. How far does that reach? I mean, are you surprised at the kinds of differences that are now being sort of socially accepted on a broad societal basis?
I think that the change comes from several directions at once. It comes partly from a grassroots movement of ordinary people who are affected by a condition. And then it comes additionally from the sort of scientists and thinkers in an area. And finally, we live in a celebrity culture and celebrities make a big difference. I mean, when one looks at the gay rights movement, I think one inevitably is looking at how many people came out of the closet and talked about the fact that they were gay. But you're also looking at what happened when a few major celebrities like Rock Hudson were effectively exposed as being gay and then spoke out about it. You're looking really at a culture in which things come from both ends. I've been looking at the issue of being transgender. Sonny and Cher's son, Chaz Bono, came out as a transgender male. That was a gigantic shift. It shifted public perception. It made people think, oh, okay, this doesn't just happen to people at the margins. This happens to people at the very center. But my book is largely about families, and it's about families because I think families are so often what mediates between the individual and the larger culture. The celebrities are great, and they make a big difference, and celebrities who are willing to be open about who they are making the world a better place. But it's actually the individual families that are really negotiating these transitions.
Well, let's talk about the families where the first level of acceptance, or I guess non-acceptance, sort of has to happen when a kid is born or comes to understand themselves as different. What makes it so difficult initially for parents to accept that their child is not like them or has one of these characteristics that puts them in a different identity?
Before I started working on this book, I thought there was just this one thing that was parental love. And I thought that often parents stopped loving their children when they found out their children had these differences. And I felt that my own parents had been unloving in their response to the news that I was gay. And then as I worked on the book, I began to think that there are really two things that are very tightly entwined, love and acceptance. Most parents love their children. Most parents love their children from shortly after they're born. We all, of course, know stories of abuse and neglect. But by and large, parents love their children. But accepting your child is a different enterprise, and it can take a long time. And one of the arguments of the book is that a lot of us, we use this word reproduction when we talk about having children as if we were making another version of ourselves or some version of ourselves and our partner. But actually, what we do is an act of production. And the act of production is that we produce children who are themselves. They're separate people. They're different from what we had in mind when we decided to have children. They're different from who we are. They are themselves. And so I think parents often go through a trauma of realizing, oh, my child isn't just going to play out my fantasies. My child is going to be his own person and do things in his own very different way. And people are afraid of difference. People are afraid of difference of every kind. And parents are afraid of having children who are so different, and they're afraid at two levels. They're afraid in the first place because they think that difference may cause their child enormous suffering, and they're afraid in the second place because they now will have to take on an identity as the parent of a child who's gay or who's disabled or who's whatever else it is, even who's a prodigy, which is not as sad but equally overwhelming, they will have to take on this new identity and they don't know how. And it's a very frightening and intimidating task.
I think a lot of people will be surprised that you put the identity of being a child prodigy, or for parents, the challenge of having a really talented kid in the same category as the challenge of having a child with schizophrenia or a child who's autistic.
One of my central arguments is that what's difficult is the fact of having a child who's very different from you. And it doesn't really matter whether the difference is a positive difference or a negative difference. Many parents of children with severe differences of one kind or another are overwhelmed by having those children and overwhelmed by the difficulty of it. As for the families of prodigies, I mean, it's less sad to have a child who's a prodigy than it is to have a child who has severe disabilities. But it's not easier. So in the same way that having the mind of a 4-year-old and the body of a 30-year-old is a lonely enterprise, so having the mind of a 30-year-old and the body of a 4-year-old is a lonely experience. Your child either spends time with people who share his interests, most of whom have no desire to become friends with a 4-year-old, or you put your child in a room with other 4-year-olds who haven't the slightest idea what he's talking about. And so you as parents have to deal with that asynchrony, the sense that your child has some characteristics that are very advanced but is probably still emotionally a child. And how do you make sense of that? It's hard to find peers. The parents will have to figure out how to bring this child up in a way that supports his special interest and yet doesn't overexpose him and cause him to have a nervous breakdown, as many prodigies who do a lot of performing early on tend to do. They have to find a new community of people who have experience in dealing with the situation. It's the surprise of the other chapters was how much joy there could be even in the experience of having a child with disabilities. And the surprise of that chapter was how much struggle there could be even for parents who had what looked like a desirable difference in their children.
We want to hear some particular stories of children growing up with difference and the experience on the impact of that on their identity and on their parents' experience. But we also want to hear your stories, you, our listeners. If you have ever been a child or had a child with an identity that some of society saw as abnormal or as negatively different, how did you deal with that? How have you seen others navigate that terrain? We'd love for you to share your story or your questions for Andrew Solomon. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at updatedate@kcur.org. Andrew Solomon, you talked with something like 300 parents about their children for this book. Is that right?
Yes, 300 families.
300 families. Did any of those families express regret or wish, in fact, that they didn't have those children or that those children hadn't been born that way?
The narrative of the book is of resilience. I was really interested in how parents managed to make sense out of their lives. Many of the parents described enormous struggle and pain. There were a few of them who actually said they wished they hadn't had those children. There was one mother who had a child whom she gave up to social services and who was eventually adopted by a mother who, in the words of the birth mother, was better at loving someone like that than I was. Hmm. And there was one mother who had two autistic children who said to me, I love my children and I do everything for them. And if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't have children. And I think anyone who tells you otherwise is lying. So that piece of the story is in there. What was surprising to me, however, was how many of the parents who initially thought, this is all horrible, this is a disaster, I wish I hadn't had this child, came around to being very, very attached. There's an old truism that we not only care for our children because we love them, but also love them because we care for them. And I found for many of these families over time, they adjusted to the new normal of having a child with these complicated and stigmatized differences and managed to find some hidden joy in that experience.
I wonder if there's a particular family that has stood out in your mind as the most sort of haunting, the one that you sort of can't stop thinking about.
You know, there are a number of them that stand out as the most haunting, but I'll give you, as it were, one answer from each side of the story. One of them is the family of a dwarf named Clinton Brown. When Clinton was born, he was diagnosed with diastrophic dwarfism. His parents were told that it was a very disabling condition, that he would never talk, that he would never walk, that he would never know them, and that they should leave him to die quietly at the hospital. And his mother said, I'm not going to do that. I'm taking my baby home. And she got him home. And in the course of his childhood, she took him. She found her way to an excellent doctor, despite not having vast educational or economic resources. And she took him for treatment. And he had 30 major surgical procedures before he finished adolescence, on the basis of which he now can walk, at least for short distances. And he was stuck in the hospital for so long during all of these treatments that he figured, well, I might as well do something. So he worked on his schoolwork, and they sent tutors around to work with him. And he ended up having academic accomplishments beyond anything that had previously existed in his family. And his mother called me one day after Clinton had started college. He was going to college not very far from where his family lived, and he had a specially fitted car that he could drive. And his mother said, I went by a bar today on my way home. I was driving along, and I saw Clinton's car parked outside a bar. She said, and I thought, he's 3 feet tall, they're 6 feet tall. Two beers for them is four beers for him. She said, I wanted to go in there and interrupt him, but I knew I couldn't do that. So I just went home and left him 11 messages on his voicemail. She said, and then I thought, if someone had told me when he was born that my future worry would be that he would go drinking and driving with his college buddies, I'd have been so thrilled to have that problem. And I said to her, thank you. I said to her, what do you think you did that allowed him to emerge as himself, that allowed him to come out as this accomplished, popular, entertaining, delightful guy? And she said, what did we do? We loved him, that's all. Clinton just always had that light in him. And we were lucky enough to be the first to see it there. Mm. Now, I said I'd tell you two stories. Yeah. So I'll tell you the second one, which is that I interviewed the family of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine Massacre, worst school shooting in history. And I spent a long time with the Klebolds. They had very much resisted talking to me. When they finally agreed to it, they were so full of their story, they couldn't stop telling it. And on the first weekend we spent together, when I recorded some 20 hours of interviews, we got to Sunday night, all exhausted. We were sitting around. Sue was fixing dinner. And I said, if Dylan were here now, is there anything you'd want to ask him? And his father said, there sure is. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother kind of looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute. And then she looked back up and said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. And when she and I had dinner in Denver a few years later, many interviews later, we were just having a quiet dinner, and she said, you know, when it first happened, I used to wish I had never gone to Ohio State. I wouldn't have met Tom. We wouldn't have married. These children wouldn't have existed, and this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. But over time, I've come to feel that I love the children I had so much that I don't want to imagine a life without them, even at the cost of this pain. Life is full of suffering, and this is mine. When I say that, I'm talking about my own pain, of course, not the pain of other people. But while I recognize that it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I believe it would not have been better for me.
That's Andrew Solomon. We're talking about his book, Far From the Tree, and about children and parents and the search for identity. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join us here on Up to Date. If you have stories or questions about children and identity and being different and accepting it, give us a call. 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org. Megan joins us from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Go ahead with your comment.
Oh, okay, sorry. So, my son, we have kind of a little bit different, but my son, we didn't realize at the time, but has a genius IQ. But when he went through kindergarten and then in first grade, they kept telling us that there was something wrong with him. They wanted him medicated. They wanted him tested for ADHD. They were not going to allow him back in the classroom. We had all of these problems because he was just so different than the other kids. And it took us until he was in the fifth grade to find out really what the problem was. And what the problem was is that he was bored because he was not being challenged at all.
So, Megan, your experience is that of having a child who's, as it turns out, just very smart, but it has put him into a whole set of circumstances where he is treated as different and, in fact, maybe in need of medication.
Exactly. And they, you know, they pushed and pushed and pushed us, and we really, you know, stood our ground that our child was not going to be medicated.
Let me ask...
But if they had their way, he would have been medicated.
Let me ask our guest, Andrew Solomon, how common is this sort of experience in your conversations with parents across the country, and what do parents in Megan's situation find themselves doing?
I think it points to the fact that as a society, we're still uncomfortable with difference of all kinds. And if we perceive someone to be different, we assume that what that person has is some kind of an illness. So there was a child who was very bright and who was very bored, and it never seems to have occurred to the school that that might be the issue. They didn't think, oh, he might have a different identity. They thought, oh, he probably has an illness. And that was the focus of what they did. Having said that, I have to say it's hard when you have a child who is as far ahead as this child sounds like he is to find the right placement for that child in a school where he'll be appropriately stimulated. And I think it's great that these parents were eventually able to figure out what was going on with their child and presumably to find him a suitable educational system. But I think the underlying issue here is really one of the acceptance of difference. And, you know, all parenting involves two activities. It involves changing your child. You educate your child, you teach him to brush his teeth, you teach him, I don't know, basic morals and manners. And the other part is accepting your child and making him feel great about who he is. And sometimes you have what it sounds like you had here, where the parents were busy on acceptance and the school was busy on trying to bring about some sort of change and make him into more of a cookie cutter with everyone else. Sometimes it's useful to have the school trying to do some of that changing, but sometimes it can go seriously wrong.
Megan, thanks so much for calling in with your story.
Okay, thank you very much.
Andrew, I guess I'm curious, is there such a thing as a child that isn't exceptional? I'm thinking here of the kid who's of average intelligence and average physical ability, a kid who's straight, who can hear. You know, what about those kids? If learning to accept the exceptions is so essential to identity formation and to the parent-child relationship, what about those kids, presumably the majority, who don't seem to have a special label attached?
A friend of mine who's a pediatrician said to me that it was quite remarkable how he only saw extraordinary children in his practice. And I said, really? And he said, yes. He said, just ask the parents. Every parent comes in and says, but my child is extraordinary. And I think that's the universal experience of parenting. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different levels of extraordinary. I mean, being at the, I don't know, the editor of your school newspaper is kind of extraordinary, but it's not as extraordinary as being involved in massacring in children or being the greatest pianist of our times or being someone with Down syndrome. Exceptionalism comes in degrees as well as in kinds. But I think all of the time, parenting involves the process of engaging with and loving these children who are at least a little different than what you expected.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Andrew Solomon about children and parents and the formation of identity. Then we'll talk about even more conversations about more identities, including child prodigies, children who are conceived in rape, transgender children, and other groups that may not always fall easily into the how-to manuals that parents buy at the store. We'll also, later in our program, take a look at Sporting KC's victory on Saturday night and what it means for their run to the championship. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. If you missed Friday's look back at the assassination, the firsthand accounts of President John F. Kennedy, you can find that at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, do you have a beef with the meat industry? We'll discuss the development of meat production in the United States. Plus, we look back at 10 years of StoryCorps and get the latest edition of A Fan's Notes. That's all tomorrow here on Up to Date. Today, we're talking with Andrew Solomon. He's the author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We're talking about how parents and children learn to accept being different in the many forms that takes. 816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have questions or your own firsthand accounts of what it's like to grow up different, maybe negatively different as society sees it. 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org. Let's take a call from Catherine in Topeka. Catherine, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, this is Catherine. I just wanted to comment on the having a child that's extremely gifted. One of the things, well, there's 2 points I want to make and then I'll hang up, but one of the things is that the grief is that they never truly fit in, no matter what you do. Because, like the author said, they don't fit in with older people because they're a child. They don't fit in with children because they think differently. Mm. And the other thing, and then there's all the guilt that goes with that because you think, or I would think, if you try and try and try, you can find the right setting. But it's really impossible unless your society or community allows your child to fit in. And the other point I want to make is about people saying every child is exceptional. It's kind of insulting when your child is so far off the center bead because I remember my child was reading college physics books before he started school, kindergarten. And I tried, and I hadn't been around other children, and I tried to explain that to him, to the principal of the school, and she patted my arm and said, "Oh, proud mommy." Then they gave him a placement test for math, and he got a perfect score. So there's the two things, that people think that you're bragging in some way when you're just trying to figure out where your child can fit.
Okay, Catherine.
So I'll hang up and take my answer off the air.
Thanks so much for calling, Catherine. Andrew Solomon, you heard Catherine use words like grief and guilt to talk about having a gifted child. I think a lot of people would be surprised by that.
Yes, and I'm interested that we've got several callers who are talking specifically about the issue of gifts. But I think we all want to have children whom we know how to take care of. And we know how to take care of children who are like us. Most of us think that our parents made some mistakes, and most of us think that we won't make any mistakes because we'll fix all those things that were wrong with our own childhood. But fixing all those things will only be the key to success if our children are really the same as we are. Insofar as our children are different, we don't know what to do. We don't know what it is they need. We're constantly struggling to try to figure it out. Children are so mysterious. They're so bewildering. And I say that as a very proud father myself, and I adore my children, but do I truly know all of what makes them click? It's a constant life project to try to figure it out, to stay on top of it, and to support them to the best of my abilities. And I think that we have a society which is intolerant of difference. And I think it's great that we've heard from somebody who's described how intolerant the society was of her child's remarkable gifts, because I think it throws into sharper relief how intolerant our society is of children who have negatively construed differences of one kind or another.
Well, and so speaking of some of the negatively construed differences, you already mentioned that you spent a lot of time talking with Dylan Klebold's family and taking him as one representative of children who step into the identity of being criminals. Wasn't just Dylan that you talked about in that chapter. How does that identity formation come to affect not only the child, but the whole family and the communities around them?
I need to emphasize that while I've said identity is a word that one uses for the positive aspects of an experience, the fact that something is an identity doesn't mean that it's marvelous and fantastic. So I think we would do a better job of understanding and treating crime if we saw what a central identity it is, especially for young people who commit crimes. But that doesn't mean it's a desirable identity. And that doesn't mean that we're free of the social imperative to try to control it or contain it or make it go away. I took a job working for a few months in a juvenile felons facility in Minnesota, and those experiences are really the center of that chapter. I got to know a bunch of their kids, and I got to know a bunch of their families. The surprise for me, in a way, in doing that project, and the Klebold story illustrates it, but I have many others that do as well, is that we used to think that homosexuality was caused by overbearing mothers and passive fathers. And we used to think autism was caused by refrigerator mothers who are very cold to their children. That schizophrenia was caused by parents who nurtured an unconscious wish that their child not exist. If you go back a couple of hundred years, it was believed that dwarfism and deformity reflected the unexpressed lascivious longings of the mother. And we finally moved away from blaming the parents in all of those areas. But as soon as someone commits a crime, what is the sort of reflex response? It's to say the parents are to blame. Now, there's a basis for this because parents who are extremely abusive or neglectful can trigger or exacerbate criminal tendencies in their children. But my experience in talking to the felons I did was that while some of them had backgrounds that were terrifying, and I thought, who knows what I would be like if I'd grown up that way, many of them had parents who actually really loved them, really wanted them to live good moral lives, and really couldn't figure out what to do about who their children were. And that was really the fascinating thing to me, was to think, okay, this could happen to anyone. If these people, like the Klebolds, who are kind and decent and intelligent and generous people, if these people could end up with a child like this, anyone could. And I saw a lot of these parents as trying as hard as they could to fix the problem and to help their children get better. And in the end, I saw the relationship to crime as being more like the relationship to disease than was the case for some of the actual diseases I had studied.
Another group that you study and write about are children who are conceived in rape, who are born and who grow up and presumably then learn at some point that that rape was responsible for their conception. How does that identity, first of all, get initially handed to the child? How is their life different growing up in your research?
I was interested in how families respond to children who present a challenge to love. That includes children with disabilities, who many people would perceive as more difficult to love. It can also be based on children of extraordinary abilities, as we've discussed at some length. It can be about what the child does, which is why there's a chapter on crime. And it can be even about where the child comes from. And being a child of rape is a terribly complicated situation. It's complicated for a number of reasons, one of which is that you can't start telling a child as a little child, the way that you can about adoption, oh, you were conceived in rape. It's too sexual and too violent, and you can't tell a two-year-old about that. It would be too upsetting. But then you have to figure out at what stage you do tell this child, and it can be very difficult. The other piece of it, though, is that a lot of the mothers I talked to described being deeply attached to these children, but also when they saw these children being traumatized all over again by the scene of their conception. And it creates a family dynamic which is as tense and peculiar and difficult as that which exists between parents of criminals and criminals, or that which exists between people with severe problems and their parents.
I want to end sort of where the book begins and ends, which is, as you just said, with love. On the very first page of the book, you say, loving our children is an exercise for the imagination. What do you mean when you say that?
I mean that we have to really change in order to love our children for who they are. We have to be able to imagine what they think, what they feel, how they operate, which is going to be endemically different from who we are, what we think, and how we operate. It's going to be a big shift. And I say a little later in that introduction, there's more imagination in the world than you might think, because I think most parents have children who lead them in directions they never dreamed of going. They get pulled along, sometimes kicking and screaming, and they come to insights and an understanding of the world that is expanded by those children.
Along the way, while you were doing this, the work for this project, you decided to have a child of your own, right?
Children of my own.
Children,
yes.
Of your own, and so tell us about how having children has made this more than just an academic exercise.
Well, I'll begin by explaining the basic structure of the family, which is that my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. One of my good friends from college had been through a divorce but wanted to be a mother, and so she and I have a daughter, and mother and daughter live in Texas. And then my husband and I have wanted to have a son who was with us all the time, so we have a son of whom I'm the biological father. We had an egg donor, and our surrogate was Laura, the lesbian mother of his two biological children.
This is a modern family.
Exactly, a very modern family. But a very joyful one. The shorthand is five parents of four kids in three states.
And wow.
People said to me, but how can you be deciding to have children in the midst of writing a book about everything that can go wrong? And I said, it's not a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much love and joy there can be in the experience of parenting, even when everything seems to be going wrong. And working on this book, I thought if all of these parents, under all of these circumstances, could love all of these children, then I'm going to be able to love whatever children I have. And if all of these people could negotiate all of these difficult identities, then my children will negotiate having gay parents as well as all of these other people have negotiated all these other identities, so long as I can be sure that I can provide them with a household in which there is love above all. So I don't think love is the whole story. I don't think it solves everything, but I think it counts for a lot. And it was my 50th birthday a couple of weeks ago, and George, our son, who's now 4, said that he wanted to make a speech. And my husband said, George, you can't make a speech. You're 4 years old. Only Grandpa and I are making a speech. And George said, no, no, I want to make a speech. And so he got up in front of a couple of hundred guests, and he said, I'm glad it's Daddy's birthday, and I'm glad there's going to be cake. And Daddy, if you were little, I'd be your friend. And I thought, that's what it's all about. There it is.
That's a good last word. That's Andrew Solomon. He is the author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It just came out in paperback. He joined us this morning from the studios of Sirius XM in New York City. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a complete pleasure.